On the Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
For American History Month, we are delighted to welcome with us Thomas McElvie Cleaver, a published writer for the last 40 years, including The Frozen Chosen, Pacific Thunder, Tidal Wave, Holding the Line, Mig Alley, I Will Run Wild, Under the Southern Cross, Aces of the 78th Fighter Group, The Bridge Busters, and two books that we're going to talk about today. Going Downtown, the U.S. Air Force Over Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia, 1961 to 1975, and The Tonkin Gulf Yacht Club, Naval Aviation in the Vietnam War. Both of these are from Osprey Publishing. Tom served in the U.S. Navy in Vietnam, and so we are particularly delighted to have a chance to talk to him about his experiences and what his research has told him about the Vietnam War. So, Tom, thanks so very much for joining us again today on the Bookshelf.
Thank you.
One, I was in junior high school for most of the Vietnam War and starting into high school as we were starting to get out. And one of the things that I saw as a paperboy in headlines a lot was that we were concerned that the Chinese were going to get involved in the war. And that's why we were very carefully avoiding any targets that might annoy them and to a lesser extent, the Soviet Union. But what I learned from reading your books is that that was never really an issue at all. And if they had read a book by a 13th century Vietnamese general about his fighting with the Mongols, that they would have realized that the Chinese did not have any love lost for the Vietnamese. Am I stating that correctly?
Yes, you are. You are. They are traditional enemies. The thing was, in Korea, where China and the Koreans have long been friends, and Korea has also been a traditional route of invasion into China. So the Chinese were very likely to intervene on the side of the North Koreans. And when they did, they administered the most thoroughgoing weapon that the U.S. Army had received since the Second Battle of Bull Run, a 109-mile retreat in which the majority of the guys who became prisoners of war in that war were captured. At one point, the threat of being thrown off the peninsula completely was such that in mid-December 1950, President Truman was talking about it, was listening to Air Force generals talk about dropping atomic bombs in North Korea. It was such a tremendous event. Everybody who was anybody in Washington, D.C., that never forgot. To this day, the Chinese say that they won the Korean War. They have a good argument because since then, nobody, most especially us, has messed around with them. And so when it came time to be involved in Vietnam, they looked and they went, oh, borders on China, just like Korea, means the Chinese will come and help. Because we do a wonderful job of never learning anything about anybody we're going to fight.
Yeah.
If one person in the upper ranks of the American government had read any of Bernard Fall's books before they started, they would never have done it.
It's astonishing to me. I always think, you know, these guys that get these top positions in D.C. that are in the cabinet or elected to high position, the president, the vice president, Congress, I know they go to big fancy schools, and I know they must teach history at these big fancy schools, but they don't go to class.
No, that kind of history doesn't get taught in those fancy schools.
Yeah, I'm thinking not. One of the things that I found the most frustrating about reading your books is a sense of what it must have been like for the flyers in Vietnam who get told, okay, you can fly here, but you can't fly 5 feet over there. You can come in at the exact same time every single day, so the North Vietnamese will always know that you're coming, and you can't blow up these things they're building that they're going to use to shoot you down. So good luck, fellas, and have a great flight.
When the SAM missiles were being set up, what it was, they were afraid that Russians were involved. And this is 1965, it was 3 years after the Cuban Missile Crisis, and they were concerned that the Russians might still have revenge on their minds. And the whole idea was the North Vietnamese SAM batteries were manned by Russians until late. The Vietnamese started bringing crews in 1966, but all the experienced crews were Russian. All through the first part of the war, the Rolling Thunder, 1965 to 1968, the main operators of SAM systems were Russians. We were fighting Russians. And there's even a Russian missile ace shot down six American aircraft.
And of course, there were Russians that manned the missiles in Cuba.
Yep.
I've been in Cuba and seen the rusting missile emplacements that are still down there.
Yeah.
But there were Russians that were manning them. It's easy for me to look back and say, how could they have been so foolish and think that that we weren't having a proxy war with Russia when we absolutely were?
The whole thing is that as long as one side could say they weren't involved, I mean, in Korea, the majority of the MiGs were in MiG-Ally were flown by Soviet, quote-unquote, volunteers, Soviet Air Force pilots with North Korean insignia on the airplanes. There was only one time in the entire Cold War where an American pilot in an American airplane confronted Russian pilots in Russian airplanes. It was when Royce Williams shot down four MiGs in flying a Panther on November 18th, 1952. And the immediate thing that they did was that they made that absolutely secret that it had happened. The government finally recognized 2 weeks ago this Friday that Royce had done that when they upgraded his medal to a Navy Cross that he just got.
Good grief.
But the whole thing was everybody was really afraid, and rightfully so, of World War III. They were pushing everything up to the edge of it. So, we don't want to kill Russians. Well, except for the fact that Russians are killing us.
Yeah.
But that was the whole excuse. Cold War wasn't always so cold. It was actually pretty hot, and it was proxy wars between the United States and the Soviet Union.
Let's talk a little bit about how long this is going on. The Air Force involvement in Southeast Asia began in 62 when the crews were sent to train Vietnamese pilots to operate over the Ho Chi Minh Trail in Laos, and officially ended in 72 with the B-52 bombing of Hanoi. But there were unofficial things going on all the time.
My good friend Tom Rogers flew an entire combat tour of over 100 missions in the year after the peace treaty.
Wow. I was in Cambodia a couple of years ago because I was teaching in Malaysia, and I was down that way. I thought, wow, I'd really love to see some of Southeast Asia. Let's go to Cambodia. It's $75 to fly over there. This is great. And while there, I kind of stuck out, Somebody in a bazaar said, I've got some stuff to show you. And I thought, oh, geez, I hope it's not porn or something, awful. And instead, they brought out a whole collection of Zippo cigarette lighters that were American GIs, and they were all inscribed with the year that they were in Cambodia. And there was only one of all of them that didn't have some kind of language on it that I didn't want to give to my son, because I thought he'll really appreciate this. But I don't want to bring back obscenities on it. These are GIs. That's okay. I'm not upset about that. But the thing that was amazing to me is all the times that they marked down that they were in Cambodia and left these Zippo lighters were times that officially we weren't in Cambodia.
Right.
You also address how we inherited all of this from the French and talk about how long the French had been in Indochina, why they came to be in there, and then how we happened to take over, even though we were against colonialism and were trying to convince after World War II that France and Britain should drop their colonies. Neither one of them were particularly interested, and that's part of how we ended up getting into this sideways, right?
Yes. It's interesting. When people who studied the Vietnam War have all said that when they look at the U.S. involvement with the French, they always say, well, we didn't support the French initially until after the Korean War broke out in June of 50, and then they were able to make the claim that, we were fighting international communism throughout Asia. Mm. And interestingly enough, when I was researching my Korean War book on naval aviation, Holding the Line, mm-hmm. a good friend of mine here, who was a Navy pilot back then, I interviewed him, and he told me the story about being in the air group of the first U.S. carrier to go into the Western Pacific since 1947, January 1950. That's 6 months before the outbreak of the Korean War. In March 1950, 4 months before the outbreak of the Korean War, the ship launched the entire air group to make a parade down the Vietnamese coast from Hanoi to Saigon as a show of American support of France. This was before Korea.
Wow.
Also, another thing, it was very interesting. I had a couple of conversations with some guys I know who are major names in Vietnam War history, and when I told them that, they went, what? Because it never showed up. And 6 months later, this guy died of old age, so I got him at the right time.
Yeah, truly. You also included in the going downtown lots of of interviews with North Vietnamese flyers. I found that that was pretty fascinating.
What happened when I started writing Tonkin Gulf Yacht Club, I got put in touch with a number of Navy flyers, and they all told me about the Red Book, that I had to read the Red Book, and it was the official North Vietnamese history. It was much more accurate than ours, and that was according to them.
Yeah.
And it turns out that since the normalization of relations between the U.S. and North Vietnam, that the warriors on both sides have actually declared peace. They know each other. North Vietnamese pilots have been to America and stayed in the homes of American pilots that they flew against, and vice versa.
Wow.
And so I was put in touch with Dr. Nguyen Sai Hung, who's the official historian of the North Vietnamese Air Force, and he put me in touch with two North Vietnamese pilots, who both of them had some really... One of them was the leader of the group of North Vietnamese pilots that flew South Vietnamese A-37s against during the fall of Saigon, that everybody spent the last 50 years saying that it was South Vietnamese traitors that made the attack. And then I also got the book. Title of it is Combat in the Skies of Vietnam. And it's the official history of the, and they tell everything. And the interesting thing is, I mean, they're very accurate about their comings and goings. The interesting thing, they confirm that Steve Ritchie really did shoot down five airplanes, and Bellevue got the other one. So the two top aces on the Air Force side are confirmed by the other side by their losses. Randy Cunningham, on the other hand, the Navy ace, the North Vietnamese definitely credit him with two, and they are not sure about a third.
I find that very, very, very interesting. First of all, that you would have this opportunity, and second of all, that they would be interested in talking to you.
I'm told that there was a fairly large purchase of the two books by the Vietnamese embassy in Great Britain. The books are now being used as an honest account of the war in their military academies.
Wow, interesting. And of course, once again, it shows that what may seem to a pilot seems like a mortal damage to enemy airplane, and assumes that it crashed or any just lost track of it, and then goes back and claims it. That isn't necessarily accurate, but as far as the pilot is concerned, he's being honest.
Yes. In fact, there have been studies made going back to World War I. It's generally considered that aerial claims are about three times actual losses. Because of that, in World War II, the German Focke-Wulf 190 emitted black smoke out the exhaust, and the pilot jammed the throttle forward. Messerschmitt 109 could be bunted, making a dive where it pulled negative G, just pushing the nose over. And when it did that, it would emit a cloud of smoke from the oil cooler. So here comes Mr. RAF pilot or Mr. American Air Force pilot, and they're shooting at the airplane, and the guy makes the other guy takes an evasive action. He jams the throttle forward, or he bunts and dives, and they leave smoke behind. I shot him, and he smoked. I got him. But everybody, you know, there are only, that I know of, three cases of people purposefully overclaiming. People claiming events, people claiming things that didn't happen. In World War I, Billy Bishop got the Victoria Cross for attacking three different German airfields in 1915. When he was flying solo, he had no wingman to confirm anything he did. And he got the Victoria Cross for this, which is, you know, the highest award the British have.
Right.
And he became this famous guy through Canada. In fact, you can really piss off a Canadian if you tell him this story. but after the war, when they could find the German records, and they could look at them, there was no report by any airfield on the entire Western Front that day being attacked by a lone French airplane, by a lone Newport, which is what he was flying.
Wow!
He made it up.
Yeah.
Then in the South Pacific, during the Rabaul campaign, the Marines wanted to get publicity, so they ended up, the head of the commander of Northern Air Soles Air Force put out an order to the intelligence officers that you accept pilots' claims on their face. In other words, you don't have to find out if somebody else can confirm what he did.
Right.
So all of a sudden you get these high scores. And one pilot always talking about how he'd gotten separated from the formation, and then he was attacked, and he shot him down, and he didn't have anybody for confirmation. It was just him, and they were giving him praise. In fact, this guy got the Medal of Honor.
Wow.
The pilots in his squadron didn't believe him because they said, I was over there. There weren't that many airplanes in the air that day. And so finally, the squadron commander put the best pilot in the squadron on this guy as wingman for what turned out to be the guy's final mission. The liar, he did all kinds of things to try, flying into clouds and everything, to try and ditch his guy. And all of a sudden, the guy realized, this is how he does it. And he had him. And then he just dove away. And so the guy who was set to catch him, flying back to base going, well, I've got the information now. We're going to confront him. We're going to get this straightened out. And by the time he gets back to Bougainville, the word is out that the other guy had tried strafing a Japanese position on New Britain as he was leaving the island, and he got shot down and killed.
Oh.
So all of a sudden, he's a dead hero, and this guy, and nothing was ever done about it, and as this guy is quoted, and he says, and I've never believed a medal on an American since.
Well, this reminds me of the incredible story that you told in the Tonkin Gulf Yacht Club, Naval Aviation in the Vietnam War, which you had a personal part in that. You were a flyer in 1970. But back in 1964, and anybody who was old enough in those days remembers when we say Tonkin Gulf, this was the justification that the Johnson administration had for essentially unofficially declaring war on North Vietnam, right?
Yes, yes.
And yet, as you prove in here, this was absolutely in error.
Yeah, it was the most shocking. When the seaplane tender, after the event, we went down to Da Nang, and we were operating there for a month, and then we went over to Subic Bay, the U.S. Navy base in the Philippines, and I had a day of liberty, and I'm walking down the main street of Olongapo, and it's a warm day, and I happened to decide to step into a bar that I was just walking past to have a cold beer. I walk in, and there, sitting at the bar, is my best friend from boot camp, who I haven't seen since we both came overseas. And as I'm sitting there talking to him, I notice that he used to have a Navy crow on his sleeve. I could see where the thread had been cut. And he has seaman stripes on now. So I knew that he had been, reduced in rank for some reason. And then when I went to the head and came back out and saw his other shoulder, I remembered, oh yeah, the Maddox, because I saw the name on his shoulder, and I remembered he had been sent to the Maddox. So we're talking, and three beers later, I ask him, so what was that like? And he looks at me and he says, it never happened. And I said, what? And he proceeds to tell me how, when he was a second-class fire control technician, which is what he got busted from, he was the petty officer in charge of the fire control tower on the Maddox for the main armament. And that night, he three times refused the order to open fire on the grounds that there was no target out there other than the other American ship, for which he got a general court-martial for disobedience of a direct order and reduced in rank from E5 to E3. And that literally turned my life around.
Yeah, I can imagine.
To discover that. And then after the war, I was working with Dr. Peter Dale Scott up at Cal Berkeley, and he was convinced that the Tonkin Gulf hadn't happened, and he wanted to find, and he was trying to find things, and he discovered a graduate student there at Cal who had been the assistant gunnery officer of the other ship, the Turner Joy, and he told the story of going down and convincing his captain, and not getting court-martialed, that to not open fire, that they were there was only that other ship out there. And Admiral James Stockdale, who at that time was Commander James Stockdale, the commander of the air group on the Ticonderoga, was during the fight, was overhead 1,500 feet, and he's looking down at the lightning, through the lightning and the rain and the lightning and he reported that same night. He came back and he said the two ships were almost were taking aim at each other. And I thought they were going to start shooting at each other. He saw it, but yet the hell had the whole thing about the lights in the water. Well, then the neat thing about history now is that all the records are digitized. So if you run across a code name or something like that, you can put the code name into Google, and there's a very good chance you'll find a 10, 15, 30, 50 page PDF of the original report about what that was. And so I found a report written in 2003 by an NSA technician who was really interested in Tonkin Gulf, and he had determined, and it was accepted that, yeah, this is probably true, that the lights in the water that they saw, which kept not showing up on the radar, as they reported at the time. We'd see these lights in the radar, and then the radar would just be doing nothing, and we couldn't figure out what was going on. Well, what those lights were was the reflection of lightning and the moon through the storms on an enormous school of flying fish that annually transits the Gulf of Tonkin at that time of year that wasn't known in 1964. I mean, literally, the only guy in the world who ever knew for about 10 minutes what really happened, and he didn't know that he knew it, was Lyndon Johnson. When they came in and they told him about and gave him the first word that the event had happened, he is quoted as saying, "Those poor damn sailors, they were probably shooting at flying fish."
And for one of the few times in his presidency, LBJ nailed it.
He did.
Wow. Tom, these two books are just full of all sorts of information, and I can tell you, as somebody who has been long fascinated by the war in Vietnam, our involvement in it, how long it was going on before we were in it, and how long it went on after we got out, and what happened between the Chinese and the Vietnamese after the North Vietnamese beat the South and started subjugating them, and then they got into a war with China, and how they invaded Cambodia, and on and on and on. Absolutely fascinating reading, and I'm so delighted that we had a chance to talk about it. When the last time you and I talked, you told me about these two books, and you asked the publisher to send them to us, and they did, even though one of them is not a brand new book, and this seemed like a perfect topic for us to talk about. And I know you've got a new one that's coming out very soon.
A clean sweep. It's a history of the 8th Air Force Fighter Command in the air war over Europe.
Ah, that will be terrific. And I hope we get a chance to talk about that one, too. Hopefully.
I love it.
Excellent.
An interesting thing about my two Vietnam books, I got a prize 2 years running that I really appreciate. The reviewer at the Vietnam Veterans of America ranked both books in 2021 and 2022 as the best Vietnamese history I read this year.
Wow, that's wonderful.
I take it as a particular compliment when it's guys from the war.
Yeah, absolutely. Tom, thank you very much for joining us again today, and I appreciate your books, and I appreciate your service, and I appreciate you making time to talk to us, and we'll do this again very soon.
Sounds good to me. Well, I appreciate the hell out of doing it because you do a good interview.
Oh, well, thanks very much. Once again, Tom's books from 2021 and 2022, The Tonkin Gulf Yacht Club, Naval Aviation in the Vietnam War, and Going Downtown, the U.S. Air Force over Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia, 1961-1975, both from Osprey Publishing, O-S-P-R-E-Y Publishing. We'll see you next time right here on your favorite radio station and your favorite podcast on thebookshelf.podbean.com. Until then, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks for listening, and God bless.
My dad served in Vietnam, the 82nd Airborne Division. He never talked about it, and my mom knew not to ask. So Dad buried himself in work and self-medicated and would lose his temper sometimes. Loud noises would put him on edge. It got rough. So I finally said to him, "Dad, you gotta get help."
As a family member or friend, you may be the first to notice when a veteran you love has been going through changes. Things like withdrawing, drinking more, or increased anger could be a sign of a larger health concern, but help is available.
Dad finally went to VA for one-on-one and group therapy and got some really great tools to help him manage things. And I got my dad back.
Listen to hundreds of inspiring stories at maketheconnection.net. and learn how you can support the veterans in your life. Treatment works. Recovery is possible.